Okay. Nice to see everybody. It's hope everybody had an inspiring Rosh Hashanah and meaningful Aseret Yemei Teshuva. I guess we're almost at the halfway point, and should have a good year, everybody. Should Gemar Chetima Tova. It's a pleasure to welcome Shalhevet Schwartz, who I believe is making her debut on Zoom for Termotion. I hope you won't mind, Shalhevet, if I say that I know you since you were a student in grade 10. Because Shalhevet competed in Chidon HaTanach, the international contest Chidon HaTanach, the same year my son competed. He was in grade 12, my son. But so we went to Israel and we met her, and ever since then, I won't say how many years ago that was, but it's really been a pleasure to interact with her. She's knows many of our children through Camp Stone, where she served as the Rosh Mosh and the Rosh Beit Midrash. She spent a couple years in Migdal Oz, been with my daughter, who she is a chavrusa with, and she teaches now a Gemara Shir at Columbia Hillel. And she's a graduate of Yale University with a degree in philosophy, and she is currently working at the Shalom Hartman Institute, doing research in their think tank. And it's a pleasure to welcome Shalhevet to Torah Motion. Vakasha. Okay.
All right. First of all, I just want to say a huge thank you to Rabbi Kalman for setting this up, and to everyone on the Torah Motion team who helped make it possible. And that I'm really excited to be with all of you tonight, and to get to talk some Torah together. So I guess when it's hard this time of year, I'd say the September, October, the holiday season, to talk about the Parsha without also talking about something that's going on this time of year. But luckily for me, there is a fun way to bridge that gap, which is that one of the, I think, central components of this week's parasha, one of the kind of central mitzvot commandments that were given this week, is about a ceremony that happens once every 7 years at the end of a Shemitah year on Sukkot. This year will be one of those years. And I guess it doesn't really happen anymore, but because it doesn't happen anymore now that we're no longer in Temple times, but there is something quite like this ceremony, a commemoration of this ceremony, that happens in Israel, at the Kotel. And just before we actually get into the learning, I want to share a, like 15 seconds of a clip, of what this ceremony looked like back 7 years ago. I'm going to share my screen and do it. One of my greatest regrets at that time, I was in Israel and I didn't go. But it's something I still regret to this day. It's going to be happening again. I'm going to be here in America, not able to make it. So I guess we'll catch it in 2029. But I'm just going to play a couple seconds of this. And let me know if you can't hear it in a moment, but all right, we see it here. Okay.
The Ahavata et Adonai Elohecha bechol levavcha uvechol nafshecha ובכל מאותך והיו.
All right, I'm skipping around a little bit. This is what it is. Okay. So again, that was about 10 seconds of a clip. But that is what is called the Hakel ceremony, or this is a commemoration of the Hakel ceremony. They fill up someone was there and it was quite the chavaya. That's awesome. They fill up the entire Kotel Plaza. The president of Israel is there. The chief rabbis of Israel are there. And they do a little bit of Torah reading and obviously speeches. And then there's a huge celebration. So what this ceremony is, it has its roots in our parsha this week. It is called the Hakel ceremony. So I'm going to just share my screen also with what the sources are so that we can look at those together. But it is in Devarim, Deuteronomy, Perek Lamed Aleph 31. And can you all see it? Yes. Okay. So I'm going to start by just reading this out loud, and then we'll get into talking about it a little bit and seeing some of the questions that arise about what exactly is going on here. Vaitzav Moshe Otam Limor. All right, we're standing right at the precipice of the children of Israel entering the land. And Moses is kind of giving his final hurrah. And he is right. This is really right before the kind of final blessings. But one last commandment that we have for you, or actually the second to last commandment in the Torah, Moshe commands them saying, "Vaytzav Moshe etam lemor, miketz shavashanim b'moed shnat hashmitah b'chag haSukkot." Every seventh year, the year set for remission, which is the Shemitah year, the sabbatical year, on Chag haSukkot, on the Sukkot holiday, Bivo kol Yisrael le'ra'ot et p'nei Adonai Eloheha b'makom asher yivchar, when all of Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God in the place that God will choose. Tikra et haTorah hazot neged kol Yisrael be'ozneham. Right, read this Torah aloud in the presence of all of Israel. Hakel et ha'am. So this is where the word hakel, which is what the ceremony is called, gather the people. Ha'anashim v'hataf v'girecha asher v'sharecha l'man yishme'u l'man yomedu v'yare'u et Adonai Eloheichem. Right, men, women, children, all the strangers in your community, that they may hear and so learn to revere the Lord your God. V'shamarula asot et kol divrei ha'Torah azot. And they'll observe faithfully all of the whole Torah. Uvnehem asher lo yadu, right, and the children who don't know, yishmu v'lamdu li'irat Adonai Eloheichem kol hayamim asher atem chayim al ha'adama asher atem ovrim et hayarden sham al rishta. Right, shall hear and learn to revere the Lord your God as long as they live in the land that you are about to cross the Jordan to possess. I'm going to stop sharing for a minute. But, right, we have this ceremony, and it seems like it's not so dissimilar to really what we just saw. Gather tons and tons of people, everyone, men, women, and children, and bring them all there, and you read the Torah out loud to them. Right, we have Torah reading in kind of common liturgy, in our kind of day-to-day liturgy. Every week there's a version of Torah reading, but this is a once every 7 years bigger spectacle. And it seems to be, right, everyone is gathering together. So I guess it's maybe hard for us to imagine, right, what kind of a biblical, what your biblical Israelite would be getting out of this ceremony. But I think we want to ask ourselves, right, like, what's going on here, right? This isn't weekly Torah reading. And if it were, maybe that would be like, okay, you have this in your life all the time, but this ceremony once every 7 years seems like maybe there's something else going on, something else that it's about, other than really get to know the Torah. I think, right, there's the question of what we're doing at this ceremony is a question that I want to explore together with all of you. And I think I called this class, right, political and the pedagogical, because I think those are two really distinct aims in terms of what's going on with this ceremony. And I want to explore sort of both sides of it and see how in the different places in the Jewish tradition those different aims are emphasized or played out in different ways. So I want to start by just really kind of going along with if Hakel is a bigger version of the normal Torah reading process that we do, and it's really about learning the Torah, right? Maybe that actually makes a good amount of sense, right? Nowadays, we have the opportunity to hear the Torah all the time. We have the opportunity to sit in our houses and read it. Most of us, I assume, in this room are literate. Most of us have access to books that are printed and lots of opportunities to learn the Torah. But maybe what this is just, right, gathering people en masse is the only way to really teach them the words of the Torah. And maybe that's the best way, as a society, for us as a people to really kind of get what this is all about, right? We're all, right, or the ancient Israelites were all Jews supposed to keep and learn the Torah. And if they don't understand it or they have no idea what it is that they're signing up for, then how are they supposed to follow it? So I think that's a legitimate understanding of maybe what's going on in Hakel. And I want to kind of draw in terms of thinking about what this is on a couple of other texts, actually from the book of Devarim, from the book of Deuteronomy that really talk about like what it is to understand the Torah and what the payoff is for the Israelites of like learning this and understanding it, right, and what that means. So I'm going to just open up again right here. Okay. Right. So I want to take us back one chapter earlier, which is in right Parashat Nitzavim, when as Moshe is kind of commanding, again, his sort of Moses's last words to the people, but this is before he gets to any specifics of this ceremony. He's talking about, you know, the Israelites are going to sin, as they always do. And when they sin, they're going to get punished. And when they get punished, they're going to have to go back to keeping the Torah once again. And he is really kind of exhorting them that, like, you'll be able to do it. You can go back. You can keep the Torah. And he says this. It's really a beautiful sentence. He says, Ki ha-mitzvah hazot asher ani mitzavecha hayom, right? This mitzvah that I'm commanding you today. Lo niflate hi mimcha, lo refukahi. Right. This instruction that I'm enjoining you today is not too baffling for you, nor is it beyond your reach. Lo b'shamayim. Right. It is not in the heavens. Lemor miya alelanu hashamayma v'yikachehalanu v'yishmainu otah v'na'asena. Right. It's not in the heavens that you might say, who's going to go up and get it for us? And right. And impart it to us that we may observe it. And just again, to kind of specify really what this means, we have the commentary of Ibn Ezra. I'm sorry, I didn't mark that on the sheet, but this is the commentary of Ibn Ezra. He explains the word niflate, which means baffling or something like that, right? He explains what that means. It means concealed, nisteret. O devar pele, shetila ela socho, right? Is either, right, it's not hidden or like wondrous, that's something that'll cause you to grow weary while trying to accomplish it. Right, so what's going on in this passage here? Is that, right, Moshe is concerned that people are going to think that the Torah is this like hard, far away thing, right? Moses is concerned that people aren't going to know how to keep it. Maybe people aren't going to understand exactly what it means, or they will kind of understand it, but they're going to think it's hard. And he's saying, no, this is an kind of accessible text that you should be able to follow, that you should be able to understand. It's one, a commentator who I didn't put on the sheet, but Sforno, when he's commenting on this verse, when he's explaining niflate, he's explaining what it means, what it would mean for the Torah to be concealed. And what he says actually is, right, you don't need someone else to interpret it for you. You don't need a prophet to come and interpret it for you. You don't need a sage to come and tell you what it means. No, actually, like, you read the Torah, you understand it, you see the text, you can understand what it means, you can do it. It's accessible, right? So in some ways, it's actually like Sforno's take feels almost like a kind of Protestant understanding of the relationship between a regular person keeping the tradition and the text itself, which is, okay, this isn't like so esoteric that we need experts to help us understand. No, this is a book that with rules and norms and ethics that you can just read and understand and follow. And right, the central to the idea of what it is to be a kind of Jew who observes the Torah is that the idea that like this is accessible. So maybe the public reading of the Torah in front of everyone, man, woman, children, stranger, no, doesn't matter who, doesn't matter how much they know. No, the Torah is for everyone, right? And that could, I think, engender a sense of buy-in or a sense that, right, this isn't something for someone else. This is something for me. And it is in a similar vein, and it's not exactly the same, but I think it draws on a similar idea. Is going to be this text from, again, moving backwards, even earlier in the book of Deuteronomy. And this, right, this is as Moses is describing, right, what it will look like when you keep, when you, the people, the children of Israel keep the Torah, right? He says this, he says, Ushmartem va'asitem, right, keep it and do it, or observe them faithfully, observe the commandments faithfully. Hihi chochmatchem uvinatchem le'enei ha'amim. Right. This will be proof of your wisdom and discernment to other peoples. right? Because they're going to hear these laws, v'amru, and they will say, Rak am chacham v'navon ha'goy ha'gadol hazeh. It could only be a brilliant, a wise and discerning, understanding people, this great nation. Right? Himiga goy gadol asher lo elohim krovim elav, kadunai elohinu b'chol koreinu elav, right? Someone, a nation that's close to God, and then in the, here in this final verse, umi goy gadol asher lo hukim u'mishpatim tzadikim, k'chol ha'torah hazod asher anothim notem l'knechem hayot. What great nation has laws and rules as perfect as all this teaching that I have set before you on this day? Right? Again, there's something self-evident about kind of from the content of the Torah, that sort of explains itself as like wise, moral, correct. And that, right, in this case, this passage is obviously talking about what, right, the Israelites as models for the other nations. Other nations are going to see it. And they'll see these laws and see these commandments, and they'll understand, right? Like, wow, this must be one heck of a nation, or one heck of a Torah. But I think we can take that understanding and see it as, right, that's part of what it means to be an adherent of the Torah, right? That's part of what it means to be part of the Israelite nation, to be part of the Jewish people, right? Is that when you interact, like when you see these laws, these rules, these norms face on or head on, there's a kind of automatic connection to be compelled by the content of what it is that you're learning, right? And you can't do that unless you know the laws, unless you hear them, unless you understand them, right? So I think kind of what emerges from this picture is an understanding of Torah, and an understanding of these laws and norms and rules of this society, that asks, right, that asks that we pay attention to them, come to understand them, and through that come to be motivated to follow them, right? Can be motivated intrinsically to follow them, right? We learn these rules, we see them, we understand them, they make sense to us. And again, if we're thinking back to a society in which, again, there wasn't particularly a lot, there wasn't that much in the way of literacy, and there also, it's not just people didn't know how to read, paper was expensive, right? It's not that everyone had a Torah scroll sitting in their house, and we know from other places in the Bible, right, that there were long stretches of time when the Israelites had no idea what was written there. So, right, maybe this ceremony is there in order to give the Jewish people an understanding of what these norms and rules and ethics are that they signed up for. And through that, motivate them to keep them. I'm gonna complicate that understanding in a minute, but it looks like Shelley has a quick question, so I want to give you the opportunity to ask.
Yes, I'm wondering, is Hakel a commandment of God, or is it Moshe who came up with the idea almost as a method of teaching or uniting the people together? Because some of Devarim it's not always God commanded, it's Moshe commanded. And so I'm wondering who did this, who is this from?
So I think, right, the text that we have right there says Moses commanded them saying, but I think, right, as it is with true of a lot of the book of Deuteronomy, right, like there are things that Moses says that the rabbinic tradition and the kind of ultimate halakhic tradition sees as a mitzvah that comes from God ultimately, whether that's because God originally told it to Moses to say it or not. Right, we don't have that much in the book of Devarim, specifically in the book of Deuteronomy, where God's talking to Moshe. It happens on occasion, but right, like there's a general assumption that the whole book is coming, and there I think there are debates within the biblical scholarship even of, right, how much we're supposed to read the book as Moshe directly dictating things from God versus coming up with things maybe more on his own. Okay, so we have that picture. Option number one, right, Hakel is this opportunity for, right, almost this pedagogical opportunity. The Israelite people are going to learn it, they're going to understand it, they're going to be motivated by it, and then they'll come to keep it. I want to complicate this picture a little bit, just by, again, like, I want us to imagine the ceremony, right? 600,000 people, maybe more, didn't have microphones. how really were they going to hear what was going on? How really were they going to understand exactly, certainly the specific minutia of the words of the Torah? It seems like that possibility seems a fairly unlikely one. And also, right, like, it's not necessarily clear that everyone was educated enough to understand what the context of, or the text and the context, despite what it says earlier in Deuteronomy, that it is not up in heaven and that theoretically anyone could understand it, right? You're bringing little children. So it's maybe not clear that, like, that was going to be totally possible. And I want to briefly glance at two different texts that I think they don't say this explicitly, but I think they hint that, like, they hint at or gesture toward the notion that, okay, maybe the pedagogy of hear the content of the Torah and understand it isn't all that's going on. So I'm going to begin with Rashi's commentary on this, which is based on the Talmud's, based on a kind of Talmudic back and forth about what this could mean. But the basis for, I think, understanding this, Rashi is the kind of traditional halakhic understanding that women are not obligated in the commandment of Torah study, which we could talk about that for 3 hours, but I think we're going to mostly table it for now, other than just kind of understanding it as background of what's going on here. So on the one hand, women are exempt from Torah study. On the other hand, they're clearly included in this hakel, in this hakel commandment, right? It literally says ha-nashim, ha-top. Women are clearly supposed to be there. It's clearly important that they're there. And so what Rashi says, and this is a very, very short, short passage right here, but what he says is right here, right? It says, regather the men and the women and the children, and it also says, so that they will learn and so that they will so that they will listen, hear, hark, take heed, pick your translation. And what Rashi says is, right, ha'anashim, when it says the men, okay, they're to learn, but when it says the women, it's to listen. This other verb that has to do with hearing. And again, I think the gender nature of this is, right, its own question, and I think there is definitely what to unpack and what to understand. But the thing that I want to point to here is just that there are these two distinct purposes or two distinct ends that Rashi's naming for us, and they're each one word, so he's not going into tons of detail about what that could mean. But right, one is to learn, and again, kind of, he's drawing on this notion of Torah study as a general commandment that the Jewish people, and specifically the males, are commanded there. And the other is something else, which is called listening, whatever that is. So the next gesture at that comes from the Sefer HaChinuch, which is a book basically that tries to systematically go through every commandment in the Torah and explain some of the basic, how do you do it? What's the scriptural source of this? There's a section for every mitzvah, for every commandment, called Mishorshei HaMitzvah, right? What are the roots of the law, or the kind of foundations, or what's the purpose? What's the idea behind the law? So I'm going to, right, this is mitzvah number 612. We're really getting to the end right there. We're one shy of the end. And I'm just going to read this in English, and I'll also maybe mess with the translation because I don't love this translation right here. Right, the reason for this commandment is the entire essence of the people of Israel is the Torah. Through it, they are separated from every nation and language, right? They're distinct to be meritorious for life of the forever, for the eternal life, afterlife, unclear, but don't like life of the forever. So I'm skipping to the next sentence. Therefore, since their entire essence is in the Torah, right, it's fitting that everyone should gather together at one point in time to hear its words. And for the voice to go out amongst the whole nation, which I would say the best way of rendering that is probably so everyone's all talking about it, men, women, and infants, to say, what is the great gathering that we have all been gathered together? And the answer would be to hear the words of the Torah, which is our entire essence and glory and splendor. And they will come from this to tell of the great praise and splendor of its value, and its yearning will enter all their hearts. And with this yearning for it, they will learn to know and merit good. And God will be happy with his creations, like the matter that's written in the explanation of this commandment, in order that they will learn and fear the Lord. Okay. So what the Sefer HaChinuch here is kind of also pointing at, right, is that they're going and they're listening to the words, but what they're not necessarily going to actually hear the words, right? The thing that they will come to know is not the content of what's being read, but it is the fact that this is being read, right? They see this whole big thing going on. They're turning to each other. They're asking, hey, like, what's up with this? What's going on? And then the answer, right? It feels almost reminiscent of like a Pesach Seder, right? You do all this weird stuff. It's unclear exactly why you're doing all this weird stuff. But really you do all this weird stuff so that the kids ask, hey, what's going on? And then you can explain, actually, the reason that we're doing all this weird stuff is because we were once slaves in Egypt. So this is a sort of a similar idea, right? Everyone comes together and you're in this huge crowd and you can't hear what's going on. Then you say like, hey, what's this about? At which point the people who understand will answer, it's because it, right, that we're coming to read the words of the Torah, which are the essence of who we are as people. And the other thing that I kind of enjoyed about this excerpt at the end, right, the verse itself says, Lama'an, right, Lama'an yil medu viyiru et hash, right, et adon Elohim, right, so that they'll learn, and they will come to fear the Lord. So you might think, right, that what they're coming to learn is the content of the Torah, and that will make them fear the Lord, right? Again, this sort of intrinsic motivation thing that we were talking about before, right? Like the nations who see the Israelites practicing this amazing religion, and they're like, wow, these mitzvot are awesome. But what kind of how he almost like turns that on its head, he's saying, no, right? It's not that they're going to necessarily learn the content. It's that they're going to kind of understand that this Torah that they have is this great, glorious, splendor-filled thing because, hey, look, there are 600,000 people outside the stadium or outside the Kotel Plaza, and that's like a really powerful experience. And that's what they'll learn. And that's kind of where they'll come to know and love God. So I think we see kind of both from this Rashi and from the Sefer HaChinuch that that maybe what's going on is something a little bit different from simply coming to know, learn, and understand the content. And what I want to offer with kind of the next 30 minutes is a couple of different frameworks for understanding, right? Frameworks from more like philosophical, political, and religious thought that might help us understand what that else is. And then to hopefully kind of go through a couple of what I would call case studies together with you, places in the Torah or in Tanakh and in the rabbinic tradition where this happened. This ceremony happened, and talk about how those different ends, those different goals of the Hakel ceremony were kind of emphasized differently in each case, and how those goals also might be a little bit in tension with one another. Sima, you have your hand up. Go for it.
Yeah, I was just two things I was thinking about. One was that maybe it's this Hakel ceremony is to bring us back as a nation to Ma'amad Har Sinai, just kind of a ceremony to commemorate that event in the grandness of it, that people will be asking, will bring us back to that collective memory of Ma'amad Har Sinai. That was one thought I had. And the other is that indeed in Sefer Ezra, you get a little sense of this reading of the Torah for the first time in so many years during Shivat Zion, when it was so powerful and so meaningful to the nation, so that brought them to tears. So there had to be a real emotional significance to this kind of event, even we see it historically. So I would imagine year after year, it had that some kind of impact, depending on where the nation was holding at the time.
So absolutely. And I think one Ezra will get to, hopefully, as one of those case studies. But I think your articulation of bringing us back to Ma'amad Har Sinai, right, like, is a really important insight in that I think that's for sure part of what's going on. And, but even understanding, right, like what that does, right. Ma'amad Har Sinai, almost you have the same question about, right. Like obviously Ma'amad Har Sinai had this additional element of being the literal revelation of God's presence. Right. And so maybe this is about bringing us there. What'd you say?
Okay. Eric? I wanted to add this, that I learned about especially on Rashi, about the when you assert a verb twice, you don't mean both, just you mean emphasis. So I will hear and I will think of it this way. I am good and ready doesn't mean I am good and I am ready. It means I am really ready, which I think obviates the whole question of, oh, and the men this and the women that.
Right. So I think that if you're talking about like what is a plain sense reading of the text, I think you're right. Laman yomadu and laman yishmu are probably two ways of saying, or might be two ways of saying the same thing. Or at least that's a totally valid possibility, right? That again, like it also could be, right? Those two verbs aren't, often that happens when you have synonyms. These aren't exactly synonyms, right? Learning and hearing, maybe, right? They could be different words. But I think that is a totally plausible read, again, a read of the plain sense of the text. I think the question is just, right, like what else? It's Rashi's problem that he's trying to solve, I think, in at least in large part, or he's drawing on a rabbinic tradition that's trying to solve for the fact that women traditionally aren't obligated in Torah study. But I think what emerges from Rashi, whether or not it's a necessary read of the text, is this notion that actually there might be two separate, right? There might be two separate ends, or like two separate goals of this activity in the first place. And he can say that whether or not it automatically emerges from the text or not. Okay. So with that, I wanna read together two texts that are not from the Jewish canon. One from, I would say, historic, like medieval philosophical, political, legal thought, and the other from more modern religious studies, that both get at, I would say, both they get at two different conceptions of right, why one might have a ceremony like this, and right, the first is a text from Thomas Aquinas, important Christian theologian who wrote a very, very long treatise on everything religion, law, and politics. And there's a part of that treatise is what he calls a treatise on law, where he's trying to understand, okay, like what is law? What gives law its force? What makes law binding? When is it binding? When is it not binding? And what he's also trying to do is he's situating himself in the Christian tradition, but also trying to understand, right? He's also kind of working from the Greco-Roman natural law tradition. And he's trying to harmonize those two things. So on the one hand, right, you have the Christian notion of, or the, I would say like the biblical notion of that there are laws that are handed down to you in a kind of what he would call positive law, laws that are handed down to you by particular people in positions of authority. And on the other hand, you have this thing called natural law, right, which you could maybe think of as like self-evident ethics or other kinds of norms that you can just reason from reason alone. And he's trying to figure out, okay, what do those two things have in common? How can we understand both of those as like genres of the same category, both of which are law? And what are the kind of essential features that all law has? And so, one of the options for the essential features that all law has is what he calls promulgation, right? All law, he argues, has to be promulgated, or in some way has to be basically given to or expressed to the people who are going to be bound by that law, right? If I'm a king, I can't decide in my head what the law is going to be, and then decide that all of my subjects are bound to follow it. And if they don't, they're like liable for the death penalty. That's not law. That's like the whims of an arbitrary dictator. No, law requires promulgation. And so this passage, I'm not sure, we might skip around in it because it's a bit long, but the way that he frames each of his sections is in this kind of like weird and roundabout way, where he says, like, basically he has something that he thinks is true, right? Like law needs to be promulgated. And then he raises a bunch of possible objections or reasons why he might think that's wrong. And then he's like, no, I think this is true. And then he responds to all of those objections. So I'm gonna share my screen one more time right here. Okay. So he's again promulgation, right? His first objection: seeing the promulgation is not necessary, right? For the natural law, above all, has the character of law. Natural law, which you just figure out from reason alone, right? That's law, but it needs no promulgation. Therefore, it is not essential to a law that it be promulgated. Then, right, number two, he basically says, and we can don't have to read it inside, but it can bind people who aren't there when you, right, if I publish a law book, even an American citizen who hasn't read that law book or wasn't there when the law book was published is still obligated to keep American law. And similarly, it extends to the future, meaning my grandkids are also going to have to follow America. I have to follow the Constitution, even though it was passed in 1790s. So then he says, no. As stated above, a law is imposed on others by way of a rule and measure. Right now, a rule and measure is imposed by being applied to those who are to be ruled and measured by it, right? Again, so in order that the law obtain binding force, which is proper to a law, it must needs be applied to the men who have to be ruled by it. Such application is made by being notified to them by promulgation. Wherefore, promulgation is necessary for the law to obtain its force, right? That's the definition of law. And then again, when he goes to respond to the objections, and I think the response to objection one might actually be interesting to us, which is the natural law is promulgated by the very fact that God instilled it into man's mind so as to be known by him naturally, right? We don't need anyone to publish a book of natural law because actually all of us have the capacity to know it and understand it by ourselves. So again, what he's saying here is that an essential feature of law, and again, it's not just a definitional question. What he's saying is that in order for law to be properly binding, to be legally legitimate, it has to be expressed to the people who are going to keep it in some way. Right. And that you can't just have your law book, or your code that says all the things that people need to do. But if people were never made aware of that, right, it's not a fair standard to hold them to. Right. So there's a way to understand this Hakel ceremony as essentially doing just that, as a way of promulgating the law, not so that people necessarily like understand it and are therefore internally motivated to keep it, right? Not because they're necessarily reading this and being like, oh, this great law makes perfect sense. I'm totally down to follow all of the meets vote. But maybe it's because, right, then when later on they stop keeping it and God decides to punish them, right, there's a way that this feels, right, like it gives legitimacy in a way that it didn't necessarily happen. And not only God, right? This is the king who gets up there and reads it. So right. It might be that part of what this is about, or at least one of the functions of the Hakel ceremony, whether or not that's like necessarily the original intention of the Devarim text, but one of the functions of the ceremony is to lend a certain kind of legal legitimacy or authority to the people who are going out there and teaching the law. I think it's also worth noting, right, that natural law, right, the kind of law that is self-evident and obvious, he says, it's kind of automatically promulgated. You don't need to get up there and have a big ceremony in order to learn and to understand the law. But positive law, which doesn't necessarily make sense and is the kind of thing that your leader is articulating and that you have to obey by virtue, basically, you have to obey not because it is objectively correct in some cosmic way, but you have to obey because someone said so, right? That kind of law is the kind of law that needs explicit promulgation. So if we're thinking along those terms, right, then it's almost the opposite of what we hear of that idea that like this law, once it's kind of understood and read, will be self-evident and therefore intrinsically motivating, right? It's not the case that anyone who reads this law will necessarily be like, okay, makes sense. I'm going to choose to do it now. Maybe, right, it's the case that that's the only way that the kind of political, right, that this law has legitimacy as positive law, like just explicitly as the kind of law that isn't necessarily obvious to all of us, right? That's why we need to promulgate it. So that's kind of option number one, in terms of this kind of additional layer of what can a ceremony like this give us? And he also says, right, it's not necessarily that everyone who's there needs to fully understand it, but it's just that they need to be able to access it, or that the other people can explain it to them. As long as it was promulgated in a serious way, right, it might be that if there's a small child there who doesn't understand what's going on, but if every 7 years the ceremony is happening, there are enough people who know it, that now, okay, it's legitimate. Option number two is going to, we're going to jump forward several hundred years and read some Durkheim. He's a theorist of religion who wrote a very famous book called On the Elementary Forms of Religious Life, which what he's doing is, right, he really is what the kind of father in a lot of ways of the modern study of religion, where he's trying to understand religion as a social phenomenon, right? He's trying to understand, right, what is it about religion, religious ritual, ceremony that makes people tick, and how does it, what are the different kinds of functions that it serves in a kind of sociological way? He's, a lot of his work is sociological and anthropological, right? He studies, he studies a lot of different societies with many different kinds of religious practices and tries to understand what's going on. And one of the most famous kind of Durkheimian concepts, which I don't think he uses the words in this specific passage that I'm going to share, but this is it, like in his chapter on it, is the concept of what he would call collective effervescence, which is the idea that a lot of what happens in religious ritual, right, is this thing that happens when lots of people are experiencing together something that feels very grand and very important and very compelling. And right, he wants to argue that thing itself, no matter what the content is, right, that can be motivating in and of itself in a particular kind of way. It gives people a sense of connection to something cosmic, something much greater and transcendent, right? And part of what that's coming from is this like mass collective experience. And he argues that that serves a very important political purpose as well, not about legal legitimacy, but about authority. And kind of granting and making political authority in certain ways feel self-evident to the people who are kind of people who are experiencing that authority. So I'm just going to read this passage. Right, there are occasions when the strengthening and vivifying action of society is especially apparent. Right, in the midst of an assembly animated by a common passion, we become susceptible of acts and sentiments which we were incapable of and reduced to our own forces. When the assembly is dissolved, and when finding ourselves alone again, we fall back into our ordinary level, right? We are then able to measure the height to which we have been raised above ourselves, right? Like every so often we have these experiences that really take us in a way that's, take us somewhere that's different than our ordinary life, right? History abounds in examples of this sort. It is enough to think of the night of the 4th of August, 1789. This is an event in the French Revolution. I think it's when like the Fourth Estate was abolished or something. When an assembly was suddenly led to an act of sacrifice and abnegation, which each of its members had refused the day before, and at which they were all surprised the day after. This is why all parties, political, economic, or confessional, are careful to have periodical reunions where their members may revivify, I love that word, revivify their common faith by manifesting it in common. To strengthen those sentiments, which, if left to themselves, would soon weaken, it is sufficient to bring those who hold them together and to put them into closer and more active relations with one another. This is the explanation of the particular attitude of a man speaking to a crowd. I'm going to actually skip this part. He basically argues that when someone's giving a big speech to a huge group of people, he acts super different than the way that I would talk to someone, just like if I'm having a one-on-one conversation. Right. It's by this trait that we are able to recognize what has often been called the demon of oratorical inspiration. Right. There's this thing that happens to people when they're speaking to big groups. Now, this exceptional increase of force is something very real. It comes to him from the very group which he addresses. The sentiments provoked by his words come back to him, but enlarged and amplified. And to this degree, they strengthen his own sentiment. And he keeps going for a little bit about the kind of the rhetorical, right, the rhetoric aspect of this. But the idea that, like, when you have a big crowd that comes together, it allows us to connect to something kind of cosmic, to something big. And he goes on to actually say, and it's not necessarily in this passage, but that one of the kind of after effects of this, or not even after effects, one of the effects of this is political authority, right? Ah, interesting. Yeah, the idea that Berov Am Hadrat Melech sort of fits into the idea. I'm just gonna translate what you put in the chat there, right? Basically, the dignity or majesty of the king, aka God, is kind of increased the more people you bring, right? And that's generally a principle in the Jewish tradition that explains why you need larger groups of people for certain kinds of events. And I think it's absolutely right. Right. But one of the things that Durkheim kind of how he introduces this passage, I think it's earlier in the chapter, is he says, hey, look, one of the things that happens here is that you start to listen to people in these kinds of, right, through these kinds of ceremonies, you become convinced of the legitimacy or authority of the people who are kind of granting them or like making them happen, right? Again, he has that whole passage about the orator, right? The person who's like speaking in this huge crowd and how they can kind of get everyone jazzed up. And one of the things that he says is that when you have this kind of collective effervescence, this experience that everyone has of something transcendent together, then all of a sudden this person, right, like you're willing to listen to them, not because of the content of what they're saying, but simply because of the fact that they're saying it and that they've kind of brought you into this experience, right? It turns the experience into something transcendent or sacred in a way that actually like lends it more authority. I'm just looking at the chat there. Revivifying the laws by gathering in Durkheimian ceremonies, as we do on the Yamim Noraim. I personally, like, I experienced that for sure on the Yamim Noraim. I think maybe one of the things that I find sort of most counterintuitive, but until you realize that it's an indicator of this particular phenomenon, is the idea that one of the biggest things that we all do, one of the most meaningful parts of the Yom Kippur experience for a lot of American Jews is Kol Nidre, which when you really read the words, right, it is about nullifying some oaths that we made, but like the whole passage of Kol Nidre, V'koname, V'esare, it's just like a whole lot of words for oath that like kind of mean the same thing. But like when you say it, when you have everyone in the room wearing white and everyone can, and they bring out the Torah scrolls, and the cantors there standing there wearing their kittel, and belting out the word v'kinu yeh in a really loud voice, right? Like it could mean anything. It could mean the most transcendent, or it feels like it means the most transcendent thing. That could be dangerous though, right? 100%. And I think that like, especially with Durkheim, right? He's a thinker about religion. He's not a religious person. At least as far as I know, I might be wrong about that. Feel free to correct me. Right. If part of what he's talking about is right, the social payoff of these religious, right? Like there's some disenchantment to that, to thinking about religious experience in this way, when you're like, oh, actually, right, this thing that you thought was about connecting with the divine, like was about like really experiencing the divine, might have just been like a big feeling that you had when surrounded by this group of people. Right. So it is both dangerous that can happen, and maybe it's also dangerous to think about it that way. Right. But on the other hand, it's also kind of undeniable that like we really, I think it's a deeply human thing to feel moved in this almost sacred and transcendent way by crowds that are having some kind of shared experience. So again, I think with both of those ideas can kind of bring a different kind of understanding of what's going on with Haka, right? If we're thinking back to the Sefer HaChinuch, who said that what's going to happen is like someone's going to show up to the ceremony and they'll see all the people and they'll be like, hey, what's this crowd about? And they'll answer, oh, this is about the Torah, which is the essence of who we are, right? Like it's the crowd. It's almost Durkheimian in that way, right? That it's the crowd that is posing this question. And that there's something about the experience that is meaningful, almost like irrespective of the content. And again, I don't think irrespective, right? It could be dangerous. Part of the reason why I think we're a little bit suspicious of collective effervescence as a thing is that it could be an evil demagogue who's trying to get you to murder people, right? So again, I don't think that the content is necessarily like totally irrelevant, right? The fact that the answer to this question is we have the Torah, which is this wonderful thing, and the answer isn't, now do my bidding and go and kill lots of innocent people, right? Like is obviously important in making the determination about whether this is a good thing or a horrible thing. And again, I think it's in terms of like what it means for us as committed Jews in some way to like believe in the goodness of the Torah, right? Like, of course that matters to us. But the question of, right, like, what's the vehicle, right? What's the vehicle through which we can kind of access that kind of understanding, or come to a place of commitment, right? I think I think we would be denying something very important about kind of the how humans work in kind of political and social worlds if we thought that it was just about coming to understand and coming to kind of like through the powers of our abstract reason understand that like the Torah is great and we should keep it. No, there are other ways that we as a society mobilize people. There are other ways that we as a society can motivate ourselves, can motivate each other and ourselves to be committed to this thing. Okay, so in the 8 minutes that we have, we're not going to get to read through all of these kind of case studies, but I just want to spend a couple minutes kind of touching on each of them and sort of seeing the ways that these take shape. So the first is the first place that we really see something Hakel-esque show up is with King Josiah. So King Yoshiyahu, he is one of the later kings of Judea. We're like already getting kind of towards the time of the destruction of the first temple. And the people are in bad straits. They're not keeping the Torah particularly well. Yoshiyahu's parents, grandparents, and many generations before, lots of idol worship going on. But Yoshiyahu he's on the straight and narrow. And when he becomes king, one of the things that happens is a couple of his attendants are kind of he's doing a cleanup job on the temple, and a couple of his attendants go in there and they find a scroll. And turns out that scroll is the Torah, or maybe just the Book of Deuteronomy. It's a question, but they find the Torah and they read it and they're like, oh no, I guess we've been neglecting a lot of this. And they go and they find a prophet and they try to understand what's going on and realize that they're all kind of doomed. But Josiah decides that he's going to go on a huge campaign of religious reform. And right before he does that, he gets up there and he does something that looks a lot like Hakel. Stands there, gets up, reads the Torah. I'm not going to read it inside, but it's on your source sheet. And stands there by a pillar, which is standing by a pillar is a theme that we see in a lot of places later on. Stands up in front of everyone, reads the Torah, and then, right, we don't hear anything about people understanding it, people kind of getting on board. But then he goes out there and he goes on a very, a pretty violent campaign of religious reform, right? He goes out there and he starts destroying kind of people's private altars left, right, and center. He kills a lot of the idolatrous priests. This comes right before a big campaign of religious reform. And I want to suggest that the Aquinas reading might help us understand what's going on here, right? He's not necessarily getting buy-in, right? Clearly the campaign ends up being pretty violent. There are plenty of people who aren't on board, but that there's something to be said for like, he's not just going out there and deciding on his own that he's going to kind of wantonly destroy all of other people's idols to go on a campaign. No, he has a kind of basis, a textual basis for it. He's making a claim to the legitimacy of the kind of political action that he's taking. So that's Josiah. And then we've got Ezra, who's also a really kind of funky and interesting case study in that he's dealing with people coming back from the first exile and coming back kind of in the before and around the building of the second temple. And he too is dealing with a set of people who don't know that much in the way of Torah. And what's I think is really interesting about the case of Ezra is he gets up there and there really is, right? He gets up there, starts reading, and all of a sudden all the people are like, oh no, wait, we're supposed to do this. It's like, right, there are actual rules here that we have to understand. And it's almost a surprise to Ezra and Nehemiah. And it's not necessarily clear, but it's a right, they're getting up there in what seems to be a ceremonial capacity, but then the response from all the people is like, wait, like, this content is really important and we have to do it. And they almost like kind of have to like pause in the middle because everyone's crying and they're like, right, like all of these words, like we should be keeping them. Right. And so it seems almost like those two, right? Like there's Ezra and Nehemiah.
Ezra was a complete failure at what he tried to do.
Say
that's
more?
That's basically because it simply didn't happen that way. The various places where it just didn't work. He didn't get it done. It's interesting to see that, you know, all the places where there was Baal worship in parallel or other worship in parallel, still continued and continued on and on, past the time of Ezra. And, I think he's one of the big failures as a prophet and leader.
No, it's interesting. I think the question of whether or not it was ultimately a successful move in terms of like actually getting idol worship, right? You can make the same argument about Yoshiyahu. There's plenty of idol worship happening after that. Right. I think there's the way that I think I'm more interested in the way that this particular story is getting told here. Right. And the fact that I think what starts as something that's maybe more ceremonial almost, right, like almost throws the leadership for a loop when they realize that like there's actually an important pedagogical need, right? That Hakel, right, it sort of starts as a Hakel and then it almost like turns into weekly Torah reading is the way that I would think about it. This ends up becoming sort of one of our source texts for the weekly reading of the Torah. But they get up there and they're reading it and then everyone's like, oh no, what are we supposed to do? And so they kind of take a break so that everyone can go and build their sukkah. But then they come back and next week they're reading it again. Those two aims, right, the kind of ceremonial, more political aim, political social aim is actually kind of in tension with the pedagogical aim. And finally, I want to point us to one of the, I think, kind of most interesting Mishnayot that is out there, right? It's a rabbinic text about that kind of lays out Hakel. And this raises a whole bunch of other questions. Again, and I kind of want to leave you on a whole bunch of other questions that have nothing to do with everything we've been talking about, because I think they're so interesting. But I think especially the way that this, right, there's an important insight here from this Mishnah that I think does speak to what we've been talking about, the kind of pedagogical aims versus these kind of political ceremonial aims. And that's about King Agrippas. But before it's about King Agrippas, it's about the Hakel ceremony in general and what, and right, how it's supposed to look. So this I am just going to read really quick because we're almost out of time, right? Parashat HaMelech Ketzad. So how Parashat HaMelech really is Hakel, right? This thing that's read by the king, how is it done? Right, at the conclusion of the first day of Sukkot, on the eighth, after the conclusion of the sabbatical year, they make a wooden platform in the temple courtyard and he sits on it, right, skipping, and the synagogue attendant takes a Torah scroll and gives it to the head of the synagogue, who stands on the temple mount. And the head of the synagogue gives it to the deputy high priest, and the deputy high priest gives it to the high priest, and the high priest gives it to the king, right? So we have, and the king stands, receives the Torah scroll, and reads from it while sitting. So what we have is really like an even more ritualized version, right, of the ceremony that we see in Devarim, right? Like, if everyone's gathered there, thinking again about Kol Nidre, right? Someone, they take out the Torah and there's like a whole procession, right? This seems almost like a coronation, right? It seems so ceremonial. Right, that really this is what's happening here is this kind of ritual moment. And then what we end up seeing is the story about King Agrippas, who is a descendant of, he's not from the Davidic line, and he's actually like a descendant of non-Jews, which the Torah says that can't be king. And he reads the Torah and he starts crying because even he didn't know what it said, right? That again, like the content is almost at odds with the purpose of the event, in the first place. And what ends up saying is what the Mishnah ends up saying is that everyone turned to him and he said, "Don't worry, don't cry. You're our brother. You're our brother." Which in the Mishnah seems like it's maybe a kind of a beautiful thing that they're welcoming him despite his kind of heritage. But then in other texts and later texts are very critical of this move and say that it's responsible for the destruction of the temple. That's again a whole separate conversation. But I think there is something kind of really important about the idea that like, right, the content of the Torah and the words that they're reading, right, is almost like about something totally different from what the ceremony is about. And that, again, that's not to say that they need to be at odds. And I think those two things at their best are complementary, right? At their best, you have, a promulgated law that's legally legitimate and a moment that's like really kind of ceremonial and impressive and moving and compelling to people that then compels them to keep words that are wise and good and true. And that those two moves, the pedagogical and the content on the one hand, and on the other, the kind of social and political goals can be in harmony and unison. They can of course be in tension. But I think it's just important to recognize those as two separate goals and two separate ends, that then can kind of make our religious life fuller and richer, when they're kind of done together in this complementary way. I know we're out of time. So, Rabbi Kelman, you can tell me, I'm happy to take a couple questions at the end, but I also don't want to keep anyone over.
Yeah. If there are any questions, sure.
Okay, great.
So a couple minutes if anybody has any questions. I think you covered everything in the chat box.
Yeah. But so your hands up. So.
Yeah. I was just wondering about the connection of to Shemitah, why we do it at the end of a Shemitah year rather than say an annual reading. An annual hakel, and I'm thinking maybe I'm wondering whether the Shemitah year is a particularly challenging year religiously for the nation, and maybe they need a little chizuk at the end of the Shemitah year to kind of get, you know, give them a yasher koach for doing so well on Shemitah and putting your livelihood in the hands of God and resting the land and spending a year of learning, but I'm sure there's more to why it's at the end of a 7-year cycle.
So that's a really interesting idea. In that, like, I would wonder almost whether it would make sense if we were going that direction to do it maybe before the Shemitah year, right? Like, you need to hype people up because like otherwise they might not keep it, right? The idea is that in a Shemitah year, right, your land lies fallow. You're supposed to let your land lie fallow, and therefore, right, there might be pretty serious economic costs that people would be incurring if they were to kind of keep this to the letter. I think there's also like a practical reason, which is just that, obviously Aliyah LeRegel is supposed to happen every year, right? The coming up three times a year to Jerusalem, is supposed to happen three times a year, but like realistically, like harvest season, right? But if you're not harvesting, because you didn't plant anything, it might just be on a kind of purely technical level, right? Okay. We can tell the adult males to show up in Jerusalem once every like three times a year, that's like maybe feasible, but like if we need everyone, like we should do it when people don't have anything going on in their fields. I don't know. That's my maybe like more basic and cynical, but I like your interpretation. I think it's a really cool possibility.
I love your the Durkheim revivifying because Kehem Chayenu v'Orech Yamenu.
Right.
It's an incredible implication, as if he gives a new meaning to Kihem Chayenu v'Orech Yamenu.
100%. And I think almost the word revivifying, right? I think there's some wisdom in that in terms of when we think about Jewish ritual and different kinds of ceremonies, right? There's something important about something that only happens every 7 years, right? Like, there are lots of things that we do every day, right? There are lots of things that are kind of baked into the mundane in our life, but that I think what he's pointing at that's really important is that there's something that's like kind of particularly compelling about things precisely because they're rare, because like every so often you need this kind of reboot that is rare and that is really intense and like, and kind of really transcendent in a way that is precisely because it is so different from ordinary life. And the word revivifying, I agree that it's an amazing word, and that it really captures that.
Was Durkheim friendly to the Jews?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer. My guess would be not particularly, but I can look into it and let you know.
Thank you.
About the acoustics, I've stood on top of the old city, looking down onto the Kotel, and you can hear a donkey walking in Shiloh when his hoof hits the ground. It's that clear. So I'm not sure that.
Maybe they would be able to hear the whole thing. It's fair. It's possible, and I think it would be very cool if that were possible. And Shelley,
From the text, the Peshat of the text is that if your very young child, your infant is brought there, that it's almost like a promise that he will be a God-fearing person for the rest of his life just from being there. That sounds somewhat like the Hasidic idea that you should just be in the presence of the Rebbe, and just by being there, you'll somehow absorb something that will carry you through.
Right, you're pointing to this almost kind of mystical notion, which maybe is like even maybe even like further than where Durkheim is going, but we're attributing some mystical significance to this, right? Like being here for this moment actually like does something to you in a kind of cosmic way, right? That's really interesting, also.
Do you think that's in the text?
I'm not sure. Again, I think like there's a difference between a child who maybe can't understand the words of the Torah and a child who can't understand what's going on at all, right? Like, again, if we're taking the kind of almost Durkheimian, like, the safe understanding that I think kind of shows up in the Sefer HaChinuch too, right? That it's the ceremony of the thing. It's the crowd that like moves people in a certain way, or that at least prompts a question. But I think the amount of old you would have to be in order for that to kick in is you could be a lot younger, right? We all, I think, are the only memories that we have when we're young children are of these really intense experiences. There's a lower bar for remembering an experience if you're young, if it's a really intense experience. So I think there's a way that even children could experience it.
Okay. Thank you. Unless there are any more questions. Thank you very much, Shalevet.
Thanks so much, Rabbi Cohen.
Okay.
Thank you to everyone. Have a Gemara Tov.
Thank you very much. Okay, great. Okay, my share tomorrow morning, 9:30. Everybody, welcome. A close look at the Seder tomorrow. We'll take a look at the Machzor and talk on Yom Kippur a little bit. A few big Machzor. We won't cover the whole thing. And I'm Rabbi Liebtag. We'll be giving a share on Sunday morning. 11:15 we'll be on, and Monday also we'll have Dr. Guhertz, Lindsay Guhertz, who will be giving her shiur on Sefer Yonah also on Monday morning. So we look forward to learning with you, and all the best. Okay, everybody, Laila Tov, and a good year. Gemar Chatima Tova. Okay, thank
Shabbat
you.
Shabbat Shalom.
Okay, bye-bye.